Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday. Our guest this hour is the author of Pranksters, Making Mischief in the Modern World. Kimbrough McLeod is with us. He says that a prank a day keeps the man away. The Pranksters examines everything from political pranks, silly hoaxes, and con games to the sort of self-deception that fuels outlandish belief systems. People buy into them when they resonate with their own deeply entrenched worldviews. He is a bit of a prankster himself. He's done a couple pretty creative pranks in his time. And it's not just, you know, the pranks go from newspapers to Benjamin Franklin to Jonathan Swift. So we're looking at pranks in history, and we're also looking at hoaxes and con games as well. It's a very interesting book, what people have done and why they do it, and where we'll be, and Mark Twain, and we'll be welcoming phone calls. Plus, we've got, you know, the Yippies, and we've got Yoko Ono, and we've got all kinds of political pranks that have been done, and those are interesting as well. Our phone number for you to join the conversation with Kimbrough is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Kimbrough is a writer, a filmmaker, a professor of communication studies at the University of Iowa. And he is an occasional prankster, author of Creative License, Owning Culture, the award-winning Freedom of Expression, there's a story behind that, and co-editor of Cutting Across Media. Kimbrough, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're teaching at my alma mater. I haven't been there for a long time, but I had a good time at Iowa. It's a good school.
Yeah, so you're been a bit of 14 years.
14 years. Good for you. Yeah. So you're a bit of a prankster yourself. You've done some fairly amazing things, haven't you?
I mean, I guess so.
Yeah, Kimbrough, it took a little. We'll get to you in a moment, but it really took some nerve to do what you've done. It's interesting because you look at this and you're looking over a huge time period. You start the book with Ben Franklin, one of the first modern examples of what you call a prank. You know, I never really think of Ben Franklin as being a prankster, but I will forevermore because of what you've said about him. Why was he the original prankster?
Well, Ben Franklin just had a very mischievous streak, and I guess that's not the sort of thing that often gets retold in history books, at least the ones we're taught in school. But yeah, for instance, he used over 100 different pseudonyms throughout his lifetime to pen, you know, various hoaxes and fake op-eds and stuff like that. And in fact, he, you know, one of the ways he made his first public splash was through a big prank targeting a rival in the almanac market.
Mm-hmm. And he was writing under the name Richard Saunders, and he very elaborately wrote about the precise death of a guy who was a competitor of his, but also a guy who Ben Franklin must have thought was a fool.
Yeah, Ben Franklin was, you know, a rationalist product of the Enlightenment, so he heaped scorn on, you know, irrational beliefs like astrology. And one of his competitors was an astrologer who published an almanac, and at the time, almanacs contained not just weather predictions and so on, but also, you know, astrological predictions. And the way he made his big splash was when Ben Franklin placed an ad in his own newspaper announcing this new Poor Richard's Almanac. He was writing under the pen name Poor Richard Saunders. And he claimed that, among other things, including weather predictions and so on, this debut almanac also predicted the death of his good friend, Titan Leeds. And this didn't amuse Titan Leeds
one bit.
Yeah. And Leeds was just fairly humorless guy. And the reason why the prank really caught on and eventually kind of captivated the entire reading public in the colonies was because, yeah, he was fairly clueless or without clue. He instead of just laughing it off and brushing it under the carpet, as he should have. He instead loudly proclaimed that, no, he would not die at this date. And then when that date passed, he loudly, you know, scoffed at Franklin or Richard Saunders and said, see, I didn't die. And that only just, you know, he was the only person who wasn't really in on the joke. The reading public was, and so has Ben Franklin. Ben Franklin really pushed this, you know, to the extreme, because he kept it up for years and years.
Oh my goodness.
Titan Leeds really did die.
Died, yeah.
Yeah, and after Leeds died, Franklin wrote a letter from the ghost of Titan Leeds and placed it in his Poor Richard's Almanac. And the ghost of Titan Leeds finally admitted that Ben Franklin had been right all along, and he had just been off by 5 minutes.
You know. And astrology was poo-pooed or not?
Yeah, I think implicitly, because you know, during the dawn of the Enlightenment, Franklin wasn't the only one who poo-pooed astrology. In fact, Ben Franklin stole that prank wholesale from Jonathan Swift, who did the exact same thing about 30 years earlier to an astrologer in London named Partridge is his last name. And just as was the case with Benjamin Franklin, who predicted the death of his astrologer rival, Swift did the exact same thing. And just like what happened with Franklin's prank, the public joined in on the fun and games. So basically, Swift timed it for April 1st, because April Fool's Day was Jonathan Swift's favorite holiday, because it's fueled his desire for mischief. And basically, that astrologer who Swift targeted woke up on April Fool's Day, the laughingstock of London, and he would be kept awake at night from people like standing out in the street outside his window, wailing in mock mourning. And the director of a funeral parlor came and demanded payments for.
Oh my goodness!
And so on. Yeah.
Yeah. We think of Jonathan Swift as one of the world's foremost satirists. Do those play into each other? Is there a link between satire and pranksters?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because with satire and with irony, the audience, to get it, really needs to understand what the author truly believes. In other words, you know, part of the joke in satire and irony is, and part of the fun of it is decoding what the satirist really means. And the same is true with pranks, you know. So most good pranks, as I consider good pranks to be ones that do engage in satire, social criticism, and gets people to think.
Mm-hmm. And his target frequently was the Catholic Church, was it not? Jonathan Swift.
Swift or Frank?
Swift.
Yes. But I mean, I think more generally, like, Swift didn't withhold anything. For instance, one of his most famous pieces was A Modest Proposal, and that basically argued that we could solve child malnutrition and poverty by eating babies. And a lot of people felt like Swift was targeting, like, the British colonists who had taken over the country. Mm-hmm. But Swift was really also making fun of his own people, basically trying to light a fire under them to get them to move them to action, rather than just standing back dumbstruck at the horrible, like, social malaise and poverty that was going on in the country.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about this provocation. It's in chapter one, Unintended Consequences. Early 17th century, this small group of radical Protestants put together a prank that you say fabricated fictions that ended up fueling 4 centuries of paranoia. What did they do?
Well, yeah. It was, in fact, almost exactly 100 years ago. It was in the year 1614 when a German university professor and some students basically got together and wrote a fake manifesto about a secret society called the Rosicrucian Brotherhood that was going to basically destroy the Catholic Church and bring about a utopian age, a new age of harmony, and it would overthrow all established religions and political structures. And it was these people who did it. They were, you know, radical or liberal Protestants who basically wanted to spark a public conversation about things that the Catholic Church wanted to suppress, ideas about the newly emerging field of science and religious freedom and so on. And so they designed these manifestos, and then they used the new medium, the new mass medium of print, which had been, you know, the printing press had been around for about 150 years, but it was really becoming much more widespread around that time. Anyway, they used media to basically spread a critique of the Catholic Church and to really spark a public conversation about stuff that they were deeply invested in. And unfortunately, what happened was that it led to it was also written in a very satirical way, but the conservative Catholics read around the satire and the irony and basically believed that they were witches, that they were, you know, it was a satanic organization. And unfortunately, it led to witch hunts and people died. But
wow.
That the Rosicrucian Manifesto, or the idea of this secret society within a secret society that pulled the strings of all political events around the world, that you know, that provided the blueprint for basically all conspiracy theories that emerged since, from the Illuminati, Bavarian Illuminati conspiracy theory that came out, that circulated after the French Revolution, all the way to today's New World Order conspiracy theories.
So at its best, pranks, if they're extremely well done and perhaps somewhat sophisticated, can expose something that's terribly wrong in society, that can expose an action that may be wrong, causing people to pause and reflect on what a larger issue is, which could be a good thing, right?
Yeah. And that's what they were trying to do. And even when you have the best intentions, it can snowball into terrible unintended consequences. It's what I call in the book prank blowback, when good intentions can go awry and your prank can take on a life of its own and spin out of your control.
Yeah. What do you mean when you say a prank a day keeps the man away?
Oh, you know, sticking with my basic definition of pranks as being something that provokes critical thinking and basically turns the world upside down for a moment, just so it can be seen from a new perspective. You know, it's a prank a day keeps the man away, refers to, that kind of critical function of pranks. And, you know, at its best, even not just pranks, even like con games and hoaxes that have no, you know, political motivations beyond, you know, well, no political motivations in the same way that I talk about pranks. Even those can at least help us sharpen our critical thinking skills, because when we get conned, hopefully we'll reenter the world again a little more skeptical, so that, you know, we won't get fooled again. But the pranks also serve the same function.
Mm-hmm. You write a little bit about some newspaper hoaxes, and I'm sure there are many of these. You say throughout the 18th and 19th centuries, there were many of them. The New York Herald Central Park Zoo hoax of 1875 headlines, "Beasts bludgeon bystanders on Broadway."
Yeah, that was a great prank, and that's kind of considered one of those classic journalistic pranks that still, appears in textbooks and so on. But this was right before the emergence of the telephone. It's just a few years before that, and decades before radio. And so the newspaper was the primary way most ordinary people got the news. And many New Yorkers woke up that morning, or at least subscribers to the Herald woke up that morning to those headlines. And a long story about how basically there was an animal riot in the Central Park Zoo, and there are lions and bears and all sorts of scary creatures roaming the streets of Broadway so it's giving very specific details about certain streets and corners to watch out for, and it claimed that the New York State governor was hunting these animals and trying to defend the city and so on.
Oh my gosh.
But For those people who actually stuck with the story and read all the way to the very bottom, the last paragraph, it finally admits this is a hoax. And the paper claimed that it was just testing the city's preparedness for a disaster. But really, I mean, the reason was that it would sell more papers.
It was just for entertainment, to sell papers, yeah.
Yeah, but the funny thing is, even the publisher of the paper, the person who owned the paper, got fooled because he read the story in bed and then collapsed in bed and wouldn't get out of bed all day.
Doors
locked up. And one of the war reporters for the Herald entered the newspaper room, you know, still under the belief that it was for real, holding like two large revolvers saying, "Here I am."
Oh, my gosh. You got to read the whole story, I guess.
Yeah. But again, like basically a lot of New Yorkers stayed indoors for the entire day because this is before radio and before the telephone. Yeah.
Right. Oh, my gosh. And then they felt like idiots, I'm sure, the next day when they
finally
there
were a lot
emerged.
Of angry people about that.
I'll bet there were. So we'll weave in some of the things that you've done. You successfully trademarked freedom of expression. Tell us your story. I don't know if it was your first prank, but it's notable.
Yeah, it certainly wasn't my first, but it was one of my more notable ones. Yeah, I trademarked the phrase freedom of expression in 1998. And basically, at the time, I was working on a dissertation in communication studies about the way that sometimes intellectual property law can be used as a tool of censorship. You know, there are many instances when copyright owners have issued takedown notices to websites when they quote something, you know, when they're critical of a particular, I don't know, a book or a documentary or whatever. But anyway, I was writing this dissertation about copyright and censorship. But when I would explain what the dissertation and eventual book was about to relatives, and I would say, "I'm interested in the issues of intersections of power, intellectual property law, and blah, blah, blah," their eyes would glaze over. But after I trademarked freedom of expression successfully through the Patent and Trademark Office, I would tell them that story about me trademarking freedom of expression, and their eyes would light up. And I realized that just that short little story communicated so much more than I could in academic ease, you know, explaining what my dissertation was about. And so in 2003, I was teaching a class on these copyright controversies class, and one of my students brought in a newspaper article, a newspaper ad in our local student paper, in which AT&T's latest fourth quarter ad campaign was, the tagline was freedom of expression.
Uh-oh.
So my class said, "Oh, you should sue them." And I said, "Huh," and we all laughed, and then, you know. And then I thought, oh, actually, that's a really good idea. And so I hired a lawyer, and I had the lawyer send AT&T a cease and desist letter saying that AT&T was infringing on my trademark because they were using freedom of expression without my permission. And so the New York Times broke that story, and it immediately trickled down to wire services, which trickled down further to lots of local media outlets. And the story spread far and wide and internationally. And again, sort of like when I was writing my dissertation and I would tell my relatives or friends who weren't in the academy what I was doing, and I would tell them that story about trademarking freedom of expression, it just got so much more mileage. And so, yeah, after I sued AT&T, or I didn't actually sue them, I just threatened to, you know, it became a little meme. It became, you know, someone would say to another person, "Oh, did you hear about the guy in Iowa who trademarked freedom of expression?" And again, my critique of the censoring powers of copyright was just so much more accessible than it would be in the form of a book. You know, it reached so many more people than any of my books ever did.
Mm. He has other notable pranks, too, and we'll talk about other people in history. The counterculture years, the 1960s, there were a lot of pranks. We'll talk about the Yippies, and we will look at Andy Kaufman, prankster, the Yes Men, Yoko Ono, witch, interesting stories about witch, and lots of other pranksters in modern times and a little bit earlier than modern times. Welcoming your phone calls as well. Our phone number, if you know of great pranks in history or have done some yourself, well, call us. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter @KDunnShow. Kembru McLeod is our guest. His book is Pranksters: Making Mischief in the Modern World. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is the author of Pranksters: Making Mischief in the Modern World, and we're welcoming your phone calls are coming in fast and furiously. 800-486-8655. Scott in La Crosse is our first caller for you. Hey, Scott.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
I hope this isn't too much off the topic, and hopefully you're going to allow me some time, but I think it's a good one.
All right.
This is a prank pulled on the American public by the corporations. And what this involved is, do either of you know why jaywalking is called jaywalking?
No, I don't.
Okay, well, when they were first introducing the automobile, they had a real problem, particularly in urban areas, because people were just used to walking out into the street. You know, if there was a horse coming, they could stop, and there was not really a problem. And all of a sudden, people were getting hit and injured by automobiles, particularly kids. And this became a real big concern, and cities were actually considering banning automobiles from city limits.
Oh.
So obviously they've got a problem. Well, they went to, I think it was Los Angeles, of all places, and they said, look, we're real concerned about this. We would like you to pass an ordinance making it illegal to walk out in the street except at crosswalk type of areas. But we don't want you to go arresting people, because that'll only make our situation worse. What we want you to do is have the officers carry a card and reading it out to these folks, telling them why this is what they did is really stupid. And in that time in our history, the word jay was used interchangeably with words like bumpkin and hillbilly.
Uh-huh.
So what they would do would be these cops would catch somebody doing this on a Los Angeles street and read this out to them, making them look stupid, like, hey, we're all uh-huh. urban here. We know how to handle this. You're a country bumpkin. And it worked.
Huh.
Isn't that something?
That's a fascinating story. Thank you, Scott, for the call. I guess, I don't know if you'd call it a prank, but it certainly was a way of educating people and, I don't know, in some way kind of putting them down, too. Kembru?
Yeah. Well, one of my all-time favorite prank-related or street-related pranks is actually pulled by the Black Panthers. And it was... Well, the quick story is that there was a block in a primarily African-American neighborhood where lots of kids were getting run over, and the city had ignored many calls for stoplights there. Anyway, the Black Panthers basically took it upon themselves, knowing that they would scare the heck out of people. Basically, they set up a revolutionary crossing guard at that street to protect the kids as they cross the street. So there are armed Black Panthers,
Whoa.
You know, standing on that corner. And Whoa. Surprise, surprise, immediately the Los Angeles traffic department installed
traffic light. That's quite a story.
And so, you know, it's not necessarily a prank per se, but it was still this kind of public provocation,
right.
Very carefully designed to generate the response that they hoped
absolutely
they'd get.
Absolutely. Thank you, Scott. That's a story we can repeat, and those are good to know, as is the one that you just told us, Kembru. And speaking of political kinds of actions, you write about the 60s, counterculture perfected pranking as a form of progressive political action. Talk about the prank, if that's what you want to call it, executed by Abbie Hoffman and Jerry Rubin that resulted in the stock ticker being closed for a few minutes.
Yeah, Jerry Rubin and Abbie Hoffman, who co-founded the Yippie Party with Paul Krassner, those first two guys in 66, I think it was, basically got into the New York Stock Exchange, the viewing gallery balcony above the Stock Exchange, which now has bulletproof glass that was installed soon after their
plane.
Well, basically, they didn't do anything dangerous. They didn't bring any guns with them. What they did is they brought a big bag full of dollar bills, probably about $300 worth, and they dumped it off the stock exchange. And so suddenly money was raining from the sky above this white-collar stock traders. And they stopped trading. They stopped trading and started reaching for the money that was falling from the sky and fighting each other for the dollars that were on the ground. And it did. It stopped the stock ticker for a few minutes and led to several million dollars in lost trading. And the great thing about that prank is it basically pulled back the curtain of respectability and showed the stock exchange for what it was, which is all about money and greed. And and so that's one of the other interesting things about pranks, because when you stage a prank, the best kinds of pranks are completely participatory. So, you know, onlookers suddenly become actors and actresses in this. And that certainly was true of the traders. You know, they basically became actors in this morality play that Rubin and Hoffman had designed.
Right.
And the stock exchange realized very quickly afterwards that we should, you know, never let this happen again, especially because, you know, rather than these yippie pranksters doing something mischievous, you know, someone could do something much more deadly.
Yeah. Lynn in near Portage. Hi, Lynn.
Hi.
Hi.
I went to Palmer College of Chiropractic in the early 90s down in Davenport, Iowa. Our school newspaper was the Beacon. On April 1st, our school newspaper staff put out a special edition called Beacon. The entire newspaper was one hoax after another. They had us purchasing the local high school that was next to the college to have additional classrooms. They had the Rack'em and Stack'em Club, where they had like five people laying on an adjusting table. I mean, it was hilarious, but boy, we had such a response from our alumni.
How did they respond, Lynn?
I'm sorry?
How did the alumni respond?
Oh, they were furious that we were going to purchase the school from the Davenport Public School System, and then how dare we have a club like Rack'em and Sack'em? I mean, it was just funny. And then, of course, when people started realizing it said Beacon, not Beacon.
then they got it. I guess a lot of us are gullible, huh? Kimbrew?
Well, yeah, even I am. I wrote about in the introduction to my book, Pranksters, about how while I was writing it, I fell for one of those fake Photoshopped, one of the many fake Photoshopped images that circulate on the internet. In this case, it was after Hurricane Sandy or during Hurricane
Sandy. Oh, right,
Sandy.
Sharks.
And I didn't fall for the sharks one, but I did fall for the one where there's a scuba diver in a subway station. And what I did was I saw it, immediately reposted it on my social network. And instead of what I should have done, which is just taken a deep breath, thought about it for a few seconds and realized every part of that image was implausible. For instance, how in the world, if the city didn't have power, was the underground, underwater subway station getting light so we could actually see the scuba diver? Anyway, that's what I meant by, you know, even just plain old hoaxes and cons can help us become better critical thinkers.
Yeah, because, yeah. Absolutely. And a lot of people fell for the sharks pictures, I think, didn't they?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Thank you very much for your call. Let's go next to Marcus in Green Bay. Hello, Marcus.
Well, Samson the gorilla at the Milwaukee Coney Zoo.
Uh-huh.
And I think your guest mentioned the zoo riots. I think Samson was the ultimate prankster, and the people that follow him really kept that going. He was just full of stories. I don't know. There's just so many to mention, but he was a myth. He was larger than life, if I can say that. So I don't know if maybe if you could talk about him, or maybe your guest knows him, or I could tell a story.
Yeah, go ahead. You mean a story where Samson was the prankster?
Well, yeah. It's like he initiated all the stuff that the rumors circled around. I mean, everything from getting out of the cage and, you know, psychologists, you know, trying to figure him out, and him ignoring, you know, his you know, would-be mates and just everything about them. There were so many cool stories. I was telling the screener, I just went down there for Father's Day last year, and I told the group of people I was with, my daughters and everybody, there's a bunch of us. My brother had told me a story when I was a teen about Samson getting out of the cage and everything, and boy, I told it just like my brother. And the punchline, you know, the lady was interviewed in the hospital afterwards. She was unharmed, and the reporter asked her, "How did you feel?" And she said, "Well, how do you think I feel? He hasn't written. He hasn't, you know, called me." You know, it was like, you know, people believe anything you said about this magnificent ape. So I just think it's pretty cool.
Thank you very much for the call. Are there a lot of pranks associated with animals?
You know, the one road I didn't go down was animal pranks, and I'm sure there's a plethora of those. But no,
yeah.
I was actually unaware of Samson.
Yeah, I'm unaware of a lot of those pranks too. If you want to send those our way, that would be great. He was a much beloved ape. There's no doubt about that. Lived for a long time. A lot of people were friends of his. Let's talk about some of the other modern groups. We spent a little bit of time with Abbie Hoffman and Jerry Rubin. 1987, ACT UP, founded as a reaction to the pharmaceutical industry, government, and corporate media's non-response to the AIDS crisis. Some of their pranks were pretty dramatic and got a lot of attention.
Yeah, I mean, they were really media savvy. And, you know, I think I said earlier, you know, one of the key components of a successful prank is leveraging mass media to spread the prank. Otherwise, mm-hmm. you know, it's like a tree falling in a forest and no one being around. And so, yeah, they a lot of them were New York-based, and a lot of them worked in media, the ACT UP activists. And so, yeah, they were quite media savvy. And so they would stage these events, and they would do everything just like a PR professional would do in, you know, alerting the media, having the right hook. So one of the more colorful pranks they pulled was Jesse Helms, the conservative North Carolina senator. He strongly opposed during the Reagan era, or probably throughout his entire life during the AIDS crisis. He strongly opposed any kind of safe sex initiatives, and public funding of, you know, distributing condoms and so on. And so ACT UP, when Helms was away from his home, a bunch of ACT UP activists basically created a simulation of a yellow condom and wrapped it entirely around house and inflated it and basically turns Jesse Helms' house into a condom. And of course, media was there. And you know, and then there are other, you know, they used a lot of graphics and posters to gain attention. So they're highly critical of the New York Times and their coverage of the or at least the early coverage of the AIDS crisis. And one of the pranks they pulled on the Times was they designed a sign that said, in small letters, the New York Times coverage of AIDS is, and then in huge letters, out of order. The New York Times media coverage of AIDS is out of order. And the out of order was much more prominent and basically served the function of scaring off potential customers. They would put this sign in newsstands, New York Times newsstands. And so, yeah. And one last thing about ACT UP, they were when ACT UP activists were being arrested by DC cops who put on, you know, those yellow gloves that people still use them to wash dishes.
Sure.
I remember from my mom. So the cops basically performed their own hysteria of, you know, catching AIDS, quote unquote, by putting on these yellow gloves and arresting the ACT UP protesters. And the news cameras were around, and so they started chanting, "Your gloves don't match your shoes. You'll see it on the news," which of course everyone did see on the news because they combined humor and media savviness to get their message across.
Yeah. Let's go to Brian in La Crosse. Hi, Brian.
Hey, how you doing?
All right, Brian.
Now, periodically over one's life, one gets a few nuggets that happen to come one's way. And I had two really, I guess the word is prescient, people I worked with in high school. I wasn't part of this, unfortunately. I wish I would have been. But what they did is, in a psychology class project, they're trying to determine random selection of phone numbers. And they made phone back up a second. They tried to determine on a basis after the instructor had said that you know, there's a percentage of the mental illness in the neighborhood, and people get wild. And so they decided to do a class project on hysteria and reaction to hysteria. And what they did is they proceeded the entire experiment with dropping off newspapers called the Flying Saucer Investigators into areas like, very surreptitiously into grocery stores, barbershops, restaurants, and so on that they had, copied out of their own pockets. Stories about people seeing flying saucers and so on and so on and so on. And then what they did is proceeded in the back of a vehicle to tie a large helium balloon with battery-powered Christmas tree lights, put it very quietly behind their car, and started calling people out of randomized selection in the area in the phone book, and then listened to the police scanner and noted what the people were saying. It went on for at least 2 weeks where people were having saucers landing.
Oh, my.
People were looking at the, space creatures were looking in their windows at night. They had forced entry into their houses. And people were calling the police consistently. Well, the police finally, in the way that they do things, tracked down who the perpetrators on this were and had a very stern talk with them and almost tried to get them expelled from school for it. But they weren't culpable because there wasn't an evidence trail. They left wisely.
Yeah. Woo! That one was pretty elaborate, huh?
But it worked so well. It was just incredible. People were just hysterical, and the newspapers in the area and landing sites were spotted
away
from the place where this whole thing was. But they called people at random and told them to look at a certain place
right.
in the sky, and, of course, the helium balloon was there. And
oh, my goodness.
Across,
Oh, my goodness. We hate to scare people too much, don't you, Kimbrew?
Yeah, I mean, that seems... Well, okay, yeah. That's a really good point. Like, I don't think it's something we've talked about, which is, you know, I'm not really... I don't consider the kinds of, you know, practical jokes and kind of mean-spirited hazing rituals to be very productive. I mean, they're, you know, I don't like them just because they're usually designed just to kind of, you know, ridicule someone.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, you know, maybe, perhaps I don't know enough about the flying saucer helium balloon prank that the caller was just talking about, so I can't comment on that specifically. But yeah, on the other hand, you know, it can be good, harmless fun to
right.
to trick people.
Right.
And there are lots of people, you know, since P.T. Barnum's age, you know, in the mid-19th century to, you know, and certainly before, who there are plenty of audiences who have gotten lots of pleasure out of being fooled and then trying to figure out how they had been fooled. You
right,
know,
right.
Wrong path did they follow down to, you know, end up getting tricked.
Right. I could easily be tricked by that flying saucer thing, and I would so welcome it because I've always wanted them to come during my lifetime and just land and be these wonderfully compassionate and very smart creatures, and they will change the world. So if you had pulled that on me, I would have said, great, let's go look at it, and I would have waited for the creatures to come out in the backyard or the field or whatever. I guess all of our responses are different depending on what we're thinking about everything, right?
Well, and that flying saucer prank also points out that kind of social nature of pranks because, you know, another reason why pranks are successful is because they play on people's beliefs,
yes.
like deeply held beliefs.
Right.
And there are a lot of people, you know, when you poll the American public who believe in flying saucers. And also when you get like a whole community involved, and this can work really negatively in some instances, you know, like witch hunts are an example of how basically – you know, a rumor can snowball into something that's really damaging. And
right.
in the case of the flying saucer prank that was just described, it just seemed more like all in good fun.
Yeah, exactly. More phone calls in a moment. We are talking this hour with Kimbrew McLeod. His book is Pranksters, Making Mischief in the Modern World. And it looks at all kinds of pranksters, and you learn a bit about history during this, too. He starts the book with Ben Franklin, and he covers, well, we have to get to Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, their computer-engineered pranks. I didn't know about those. They were pretty elaborate when they were young kids. You could see they were pretty smart. We talked about newspaper hoaxes. We have other people to talk about, Yoko Ono. We can talk about Andy Kaufman. We haven't talked about Andy Kaufman at all. And other people who you figure were consummate pranksters and what we learned about ourselves and the world from what they showed us, the pranks that they did. Here's our phone number. Brian, thank you so much for your call. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's a Facebook or an email message we just received, Kim Brew. Pete from Madison wonders if you can comment on creature hoaxes like Piltdown Man, Jocko from the early 20th century, and the Minnesota Bigfoot frozen in ice that made the fair circuit in the 1960s and 1970s.
Just like with animal pranks, I didn't pursue a lot of research on those creature hoaxes. But what I can say is you can trace them back at least to the mid-19th century era when P.T. Barnum was a major presence in American popular culture. And so he had the famous Fiji mermaid, which was a supposed mermaid on display that, you know, visitors to his Barnum Museum could pay money to see, which was turned out to be just a monkey's torso stitched onto a big fish end. So not everyone was fooled, but one of the, you know, all the reports that I read about from that era with regard to the Fiji mermaid was that, you know, people would pay money to see it, and then they would come back and pay money again to figure out how they had been tricked.
Oh, my goodness.
And also to overhear, to listen to other people who are visiting it for the first time, you know, comment on it and, you know, whether or not they believed it or not. So, yeah, there's a huge amount of pleasure that audiences from that period all the way up till now get out of either being tricked or being tricked and then – now that you're in the know, watching other people get tricked
right,
as well.
Right. Phil in Stevens Point. Hi.
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 Go ahead. I just wanted to tell you about my uncle Dick Gallagher. He's probably the funniest guy I've ever met. He used to live in Winona, and they had a pretty Bush League local paper with letters to the editor. And at one point, he wrote a letter to the editor. I think he used a pseudonym. About consider the plight of the lowly Naga, whose hides we were making into furniture and all kinds of stuff. And this went on for quite a while. He would write in about the life cycle of the Naga and their habits. And he had a guy that actually put together a drawing of a Naga, and it went on for a couple of months. It was just hysterical.
That's pretty funny.
That's a good one.
Yeah, that is a good one. Thank you very much, Phil, for the call. Well, you've done some pretty out there pranks, haven't you? You're lucky, if you don't mind my saying, that you're not behind bars right now, Kim Brew. But you did some kind of political pranks for Michelle Bachmann and also Bill Clinton. Could you talk about those?
Yeah, I guess I'll stick with the Michelle Bachmann
one
because it's the most recent and it's the easiest or quickest to tell.
Uh-huh.
So I have a prankster alter ego that I've developed over the past few years called Robo Professor. I actually didn't name myself Robo Professor, but I did. I'll very quickly say that I basically confronted Bill Clinton in 2008 during the primary season when he was campaigning for Hillary Clinton. I confronted him as a robot and asking him to apologize for a political transgression that he did back in the time when he was actually running for president for the first time. And then the Des Moines Register, the headline was Robo Professor heckles Bill Clinton. Anyway, so I adopted that name, Robo Professor. And 4 years later, Robo Professor struck again when Michelle Bachmann visited Iowa City, and she visited a very famous campaign site. You know, Reagan visited there when he was campaigning in '80. Bill Clinton, and so you know, it's called the Hamburg Inn, and it's basically every aspiring politician has to visit there when they're campaigning. So I was in a full-body robot costume, and I waited for Michelle Bachmann to get off her bus. And the great thing about living in Iowa, in Iowa City, is during primaries, you have direct access with a lot of politicians. You know, I've been face-to-face with Obama, John Kerry, and you know, and so on. It's just a fairly normal experience. So yeah, when Michelle, I knew I would be able to have access to her, and so I followed her from stepping off the bus as she walked into the Hamburg Inn, and I came out as a gay robot, and I, you know, lambasted her for her position on, you know, her homophobic positions. And I had in mind like a hook that the media could latch onto, and I knew the words, just the two words, gay robot, would be enough of a book to help it circulate. And it ended up circulating, this news story ended up circulating internationally. And I also, another thing that's important in hatching a prank and is giving reporters good material beyond just those two words, gay robot. So I tried to give good quotes like, not only are you a homophobe, you are a robophobe, and that sort of thing. I will not rest until you provide equal rights to human and gay robots, and so on. So, and I could have just been a screeching protester with a sign yelling at her as she got off the bus. But you know, that's not very interesting to me. I thought, yeah, it's just much more interesting and effective if you wrap satire and political criticism and humor.
Yeah, it gets you into the papers, that's for sure. Phil, thanks very much for the call. Anthony in Kenosha is next. Hi, Anthony.
Hi, how are you today?
All right, how are you?
I'm doing well.
Good.
Hey, you just touched on my question. I'm going to ask your guest if he could speak about political campaigns that were run as hoaxes, not necessarily in an effort to win. The one I was kind of involved in is my mother ran for mayor of her hometown in 1974. She's an African-American woman running for mayor in upstate New York, a very radical agenda. While she wasn't in there as a hoax, let me tell you that Saratoga Springs at that time elected its first Jewish mayor as opposed to its first African-American woman mayor. I was wondering if your guest could talk about political campaigns at hoaxes.
Yeah, there's a long tradition of that. So one of my favorites is Jean Abel. She's married to Alan Abel, who's kind of the godfather of contemporary hoaxers. The two of them have been together. They're both still alive. They celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary in 2009. And since the late 50s, they've been pulling all kinds of outrageous hoaxes or pranks, beginning with the Society for Indecency to Naked Animals, which was basically an anti-censorship satire in which they, in a very straight-faced way, said that we should clothe all naked animals to, you know, shield children from, you know, the sight of animal,
right,
you know what.
Right.
Anyway, a few years later, after they hatched that first prank, Jean Abel ran for president in 1964 as a Bronx-based Jewish housewife named Yetta Bronstein. And the slogan was, vote for Yetta and things will get better. And one of her campaign platforms was to install a truth. Not to install a metal detector in the Senate, but to install a mental detector in the Senate, and also to put truth serum in the Senate's water fountains.
Thank you so much, Anthony. Carl in Blanchardville. Hi, Carl.
Yes, hello.
Hi, go ahead, sir.
Hi, I am. My name is not Carl. I have to rename anonymous just in case.
Okay, anonymous.
But a long, long time ago, in a beautiful piazza in Italy, we decided that the commune there did not wanted to clean up this fountain. So we just took it upon ourselves to do it. And in the middle of the night, we surreptitiously just conducted some experiment with sud. Well, it goes kind of a little bit away from us, because the next day the newspaper reported that we had 8 or 9 inches of fresh snow, as the picture would show, of this beautiful white foam all over this piazza. And we succeeded in cleaning it, but I still don't want for them to know who did it.
Okay.
That's anonymous. An old one, putting a soap in a fountain, yes.
Yeah. Oh, thank you very much for the call, Anonymous. Well, Kimbrew, thank you. What a fun thing to write a book about. And it's got a serious side, too, so you can't ask for more, right?
Yeah, taking pranks seriously.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Kimbrew McLeod, the book is Pranksters, Making Mischief in the Modern World. He's a writer, a filmmaker, professor of communication studies at the University of Iowa. And as you've heard him talk about, he is an occasional prankster himself. So thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour and to KP as well for on-air production in our studios in Milwaukee. Hold on. Tomorrow's book. Tomorrow, during this time period, Randall Balmer will join us. His book is Redeemer, The Life of Jimmy Carter. It's about his political fortunes being tied to those of progressive Christianity. So we will talk about Jimmy Carter during this hour tomorrow. Thanks, everybody, for listening and for your calls, your pranks, stories, and it was a fun hour. With a very serious side, just like public radio should be, right? Thanks for listening. Great conversations ahead.